Welcome back to Jazz United. This is Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours on WBGO.
And I'm Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO. Jazz United is a show about the music. It's a show about the conversation around the music. And it's a show about whatever Greg and I are excited about. And this week definitely fits the bill.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about the wonderful Dr. Lonnie Smith and a bit about the Hammond B3 organ and all of its trappings and vibes and grooves this week. It's going to be fun.
Greg, can I say that we're going to pull out all the stops, or is that too much of a dad joke for this show?
Yes, you can. You can say it. You can say it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All nine of them.
I feel like as long as we've been talking on this podcast, Greg, you've been wanting to talk about the B3. I know this is a subject that is near and dear to your heart, and Dr. Lonnie Smith just provides us with the perfect opportunity, because here is a true master of this instrument, someone who I think it's easy to forget how long he's been in this game.
Yeah.
And this album just, it's called Breathe. It's out on Blue Note, and it is really showing this guy at the top of his game.
It really is. It really is. I've been itching to talk about it for quite a long time. That's because, you know, when we think about organ jazz, the sound of soul organ in our music, people have different relationships to that based on their geography or when they got into the music.
Right.
It's a really a complicated trajectory for a lot of listeners. For you, Nate, when did you first kind of grab hold to the B3 organ in this music of ours?
Well, you know, because of all of those great albums released on Blue Note in the 60s, mm-hmm. you know, including some on which Dr. Lonnie Smith appears,
yeah.
That was sort of the first connection, right? It's just the glory days of, you know, the B3 in soul jazz. So, you know, Jimmy Smith, and Larry Young, and, you know, Groove Holmes, like all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I got to say that experience was mediated through recordings, and I didn't really get religion, so to speak, when it came to the B3 until I went to college in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I realized, oh, this is a tradition that really lives at street level.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I dare say that while there are some great, great albums made, there is nothing like being in a room with someone who really knows how to make that instrument roar and purr and you know, do all the things that a B3 can do.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. There's also a lot of room for error. you know,
yeah.
Two manuals, 61 keys a piece, 9 stops, I think something like 20 or 25 bass pedals. Speaking of religion, my first encounter with the B3 was in church when I was about 3, and someone had left the volume pedal, the expression pedal, down, and they hit a key, and I swear it scared the living daylights out of me. I ran from one side of the sanctuary to the other in fright.
Yeah.
I was afraid of the organ. But man, like, just like you, you know, I was a little younger, still in the single digits, but my late grandfather's record collection, man, he had Jimmy Smith Midnight Special, and all of that fright just left my body. And it was such a soulful, nourishing experience. I was hooked from then on, but, unfortunately, man, where I grew up, in the South, there weren't a lot of live organ experiences outside of the church, especially in this swinging, you know, jazz tradition. I really had to hunt to find that live. And I'm so thankful that this period was documented because I wouldn't have had anywhere to go.
That's really interesting to me because Nashville is such a music town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no shortage of Hammond organ in the sort of countrypolitan era of country music, right? Like in the 70s, I feel like there's quite a few big country albums that have that churchy B3 somewhere in the mix.
Oh yeah.
But I guess you're talking about like clubs and bars and stuff, right? just like the public access.
Exactly. And I missed the golden window because a little known secret, the king of the B3, speaking about Jimmy mm-hmm. Smith, he actually lived in Nashville when I was a very young child. Oh, wow. And was discovering his music. But I didn't find out about that until he had been gone for 3 or 4 years, and I was well under the age of club admission. So that boat passed.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right to talk about the sort of trajectory of this instrument because, you know, it has this heyday in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And then for whatever reason, and I honestly don't know what happened, it kind of fell out of favor in some ways. And I distinctly remember, I'm sure you do too, when Joey DeFrancesco mm-hmm. released his first album. I think he was 17 years old. Fresh out of the, you know, performing arts high school in Philly. I think he had already been on tour with Miles Davis.
Yes, he had.
You know, he was a classmate of Christian McBride and Kurt Rosenwinkel and Questlove. And that album, I remember there was so much hype around it. I mean, and hype's not even the right word, just excitement, you know, because his skills were undeniable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Joey D is just one of those, he's one of those musicians that will always put a smile on your face. And his mastery is so clear.
Yeah.
And so when I got to Philly, mm-hmm. you know, I was thinking about him as this avatar of the tradition. But what I soon discovered is that, okay, you know, you've got these greats, right? You've got people who are getting, mm-hmm. you know, big record deals, you know, and Joey DeFrancesco was the latest of those.
Right.
But in Philly, you also had like a whole group of people who were just local institutions, you know?
Yeah.
When we talk about the music being alive in the community, mm-hmm. honestly, that Philly jazz organ tradition is maybe the most vibrant manifestation of that in my own experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. When we think about the Hammond B3 as an instrument, it's kind of a big band in a box. So when it first mm-hmm. comes onto the scene, circa the mid 1950s, and as the 50s were on, there are these clubs that actually buy Hammond organs. Because look, you know, we don't have to hire so-and-so's big band. We can have a quartet that's got the same level of sound and only pay four guys. Mm-hmm. And it has this groovy kind of churchy, blues vibe that is easy to get right away. But yeah, you know, what you saw and around the time that you saw it was, kind of a renaissance for this instrument.
Yeah.
I kind of really started absorbing the 90s Hammond sound through sampling in a short-lived career as a hip-hop producer. A lot of the things that I was finding that had that right beat was anchored by the organ of people like, you know, Charles Erland and Leon Spencer and the guy we're talking about today, Dr. Lonnie Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the most famous sample beds from Lonnie Smith's career? I know there have been a few.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you asked that question, man. It comes off of one of my favorite Dr. Lonnie records, the Drives record. There's a tune on there called Spinning Wheel that was done by, I believe, Blood, Sweat, and Tears originally. But the Dr. Lonnie version on Drives from 1970 featured Doc with the drummer Joe Dukes, who was a veteran of many of the organ bands, Jack McDuff, Dr. Lonnie Smith. There's a break there that the hip hop group Tribe Called Quest sampled on a tune called Can I Kick It?
Yeah. As the trial flies high like a dove.
Hearing this this Hammond sound along with these drums and a new generation getting to understand how hip, how cool this thing could really be, you know?
Yeah. Joe Dukes, man, what a great organ trio drummer, organ combo drummer, you know, just like, so there's some kind of special magic that a great drummer in the organ tradition has. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's no surprise that that break became so fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of one of those, like, it's almost like a meme, right? It's like a rhythm meme in hip hop. Yeah. Like, it's been used in so many different ways. And that's only one of many Lonnie Smith samples. And so yeah, he's in the DNA of hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, something he never could have predicted, but I get the sense that he's more than happy to be a part of that history.
Sure he is. And a lot of his, let's say, socialization musically has to do with how he came up. You know, when he was in his early 20s, it's like around 1963, 64, and he's just bursting on the scene with George Benson. So there's this super jazz thing that he has. But the popular music of the day that emerges is Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And Doc actually has, for a short while, a career backing up a lot of the Motown groups and people in that neighborhood, like Dionne Warwick, even Gladys Knight. He's got a serious soul background that helped to distinguish him early on from such a presence as Jimmy Smith. And the record buying public really caught on to it, because by the time he was signed to Blue Note for the first time in 1968, basically, he's appealing to this whole different subset of jazz fans in these urban towns who are as hip to, you know, Charlie Parker as they are to Marvin Gaye. So he's got that funk thing down, and it helps to distinguish him. He even dethrones Jimmy Smith in 1969 as the Downbeat Jazz Organist of the Year. Jimmy wins the poll for like 7 years since the inception. Yeah. But the first guy to interrupt that streak was Dr. Lonnie Smith.
And 69 is the year that he releases Think, right?
Right.
Whose title track is the Aretha Franklin tune.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you know, just confirms everything you're saying. You know, as you talk about Joe Dukes too, you know, an album that I've been listening to a lot this year, partly because Blue Note did a fabulous Tone Poet pressing of it, is Live at Club Mozambique, which he recorded in Detroit the following year. And it's, you know, it's got Joe Dukes, it's got George Benson, Ronnie Cuber on Barry Sax, Dave Hubbard on tenor. And it is just, it's one of those, one of those artifacts of that moment when soul music and jazz were not only in dialogue, but they were kind of indistinguishable from one another. You know, like the music was just all happening on this one super exciting frequency.
That's right. That's right. I got to ask Doc about Mozambique a few times, the actual venue where that was taped. And he was like, man, it was a community. Those people would get to the gig early and actually help us load the organ in and the instruments. And we were happy to have the help because, you know, this thing is like moving your grandma's chest of drawers with all the clothes still in it, you know, even worse,
right?
You know, 420 some pounds of furniture.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we got on the stand, Doc is saying the energy was electric. Right away, they were with us. They were ready to go with us. And you can hear on this recording, it's a small crowd, but a dedicated crowd. They're ready for every single note of this music. And sometimes I just put on that record, Nate, and close my eyes, and it's like I'm there. I know it sounds kind of cheesy, but, you know, it's the closest we'll ever get, you know, having not lived through that generation. Yeah. You know, it's a great document of it.
You know, there's a lot of conversation around the Saturday night, Sunday morning transition, you know, the ways in which someone like Ray Charles, someone like Aretha Franklin really kind of gives us both, right?
Right.
The sanctified and the secular and the sensual, you know, it's all there. And what you're describing is exactly the feeling that I have with that album in particular. And it is both.
Yeah.
It is because it feels sanctified just in the spirit of the music, but it's also like definitely down and dirty.
You know? Yeah, man.
And so, it's a really wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, this album Breathe on Blue Note has been getting some attention because of a couple of tracks that feature Iggy Pop.
Right.
Speaking of Detroit and speaking of down and dirty, the great proto-punk icon Iggy Pop, mm-hmm. And he sounds great with Lonnie. But really the core of this album was recorded live at a room that we both, you know, love and have history with,
right.
The Jazz Standard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's a great live recording. And I think maybe we should hear some music from it that also points toward that funk thing, right?
Sounds good.
This incredible piece called Track 9.
So that was Dr. Lonnie Smith's Track 9, recorded live at the Jazz Standard, issued on this new disc, Breathe. And that one features just a killer band. Jonathan Kreisberg on guitar, Jonathan Blake on drums, and a horn section including John Ellis, Sean Jones, Jason Marshall, and Robin Eubanks.
How about that?
Maximum firepower.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know what we haven't talked about yet? WBGO is Newark Public Radio. And when we talk about towns that, you know, cities that really fostered the B3, Newark is, you know, really right mm-hmm. in the very first tier. It's kind of like Newark and Philly. They're two of the probably, what is it, the big three? So mm-hmm. so let's talk about Newark for a minute. Greg, you know, I know you're a student of that tradition in a way, the sort of glory days of the B3 in Brick City.
It's exciting, man. It's exciting to think about. Again, first encountering those classic rooms through the recordings. Two of the biggest clubs, I'll say, in the glory days, we're talking late 60s, early 70s, two rooms, one called the Key Club, another one called the Cadillac Club. And these clubs are basically almost right across the street from each other. I talked to Lou Donaldson many, many years ago about coming over to Newark and playing those rooms. He said, yeah, we had to be with it because if we weren't, the people were going to let us know about it right away and in a hurry. So we had to hit with all of our maximum heat. And it was interesting because, you know, a lot of us would play or be exclusive to one club and not the other. But I was one of the guys that got to work both of the rooms. So Newark was really a hotbed for me. And it was that because I had mastered this organ sound. And it's true, man. Lou had all the organists, including the guy we're talking about today, Dr. Lonnie Smith.
And I think that's such a crucial thing, this idea that the audiences were hip, you know, and not afraid to let you know when it was happening or when it was not happening. And, you know, to an extent, I witnessed that in Philly. You know, I mean, the college kids who were just out for a night out, they maybe weren't the most discerning when it came to the music. But I guarantee you that at any one of those rooms, you know, at Bob and Barbara's or Natalie's or wherever else, there'd be a couple of people at the bar, you know, like a, you know, an older guy with a fedora. And he knew what was happening, and he knew what was, you know, he knew when to make noise and you know, be encouraging or shout somebody off the bandstand. So yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. There's another historical recording that I'll mention also, just to give folks a glimpse into that sound and that time. The Mighty Burner, Charles Erland, another great B3 giant. There's a live recording. I believe it's called Living Black is the title of it, from 1970. And he plays a couple of tunes with Afrocentric messages. Again, no vocals. These are all instrumental versions. And you can hear the crowd at one point on the Temptations song, a lesser known kind of B-side called Message to the Black Man. The crowd actually starts singing along to the song as Charles is playing. This is all captured on the record. And it's a very moving transport into what it must have felt like to be a part of that community circa 1970, when, you know, they're 4 years removed from these riots that have wiped out the city. In civil unrest, but folks are here trying to affirm their identity and soak up some good music as well. So yeah, definitely check that out, folks, if you haven't heard it.
Yeah,
another rare recording by one of the masters, Charles Erland.
You know, that is a fantastic endorsement, and I want to toss one in too, which almost feels too obvious. But as we talk about Newark and we talk about the B3, you know, I got to shout out Larry Young. And especially the album Unity, which, you know, is not only one of the great organ albums of all time, it's also just one of the greatest sort of post-bop kind of, you know, modern jazz albums. Just, you know, Larry Young developed this language. I mean, how hard must it have been to articulate a new style on this instrument when Jimmy Smith was ascendant, you know?
Very hard.
I used to hear musicians make the analogy that, you know, Jimmy Smith is to Charlie Parker as Larry Young is to John Coltrane.
Absolutely.
You know, that's obviously a bit of an oversimplification, but I think in harmonic terms, you know, there's definitely some truth there.
Yeah. He was a student of Train as much as he was, McCoy Tyner. And you can hear that in those open voicings, in his left hand. Listen to McCoy Tyner, then listen to Larry Young, and you know where Larry comes from. And he even said that in, I believe, the liner notes to the album before that called Into Something, which I'll point out, I believe, is just as good as Unity. It's just got a different vibe. Mm-hmm. But he's like, Jimmy Smith is beautiful, but that's not the way I want to go. I'm interested in McCoy Tyner and John Coltrane, and that's what I want to do on this instrument. And it really helped and abetted him to have Elvin Jones on both of those albums. Because, man, you talk about Unity. My favorite track, as great as all of them are, that is a 5-star album through and through. But the duet of Monk's Dream with Larry Young and Elvin Jones, it is heaven.
Yeah.
I can't think of another word. It's just pure bliss. Like, play that at my funeral, please. Like, that's what type of vibe that I want there. If I can get a little dark.
Oh man. You know, this is actually kind of a bittersweet conversation. It's taken this turn where I'm like, we got to get back in a room with that sound, because you know, we sort of alluded to this, but there's something about the B3 that is so special because of that Leslie speaker, because of the way that the sound vibrates in the room. it's really pushing air, you know? And so when you have a master of that instrument, someone who really understands how to shift the tone colors and, you know, there's all these cool things you can do with the stops and the settings. It really does kind of change the atmosphere in the room in a way that I don't know if any other instrument really does it. You know, like you said, Greg, maybe a big band, right? Like a big band mm-hmm. moving together with an orchestration can do it. But an organ just has that magical ability. And so as we were coming into this conversation, we sort of struck a deal that each of us was going to bring sort of a younger cat to the conversation and just sort of celebrate. And so I want to toss to my pick now, because everything that we're talking about, the spirit, the sort of churchified and funkified mm-hmm. Combination, and the awareness of timbre and texture, it's all there in this guy. And I know you're a fan too.
Yeah.
Corey Henry, mm-hmm. who a lot of people got to know through Snarky Puppy, but he has embarked on a really great solo career. He's been sort of crossing over and singing more and putting out stuff that's a little more in the pop lane. But when you get a chance to witness him on the B3, that is just my favorite stuff of his. And there's a clip in particular that I stumbled across, and it's really just something else. This is Corey Henry. He's just performing with a drummer at the Blue Note in Milan, and this clip was posted to YouTube, and they're playing the old hymn "Wade in the Water," but you know, putting it through the translation process, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so maybe we'll hear just a snippet of that.
"Wade in the Water" from Corey Henry, fantastic organist, keyboardist, who, full disclosure, I had the pleasure of opening for when I was living in Nashville a couple of years ago. He was playing with his larger ensemble called the Funk Apostles at that time. And there was a point in the tune where there was this breakdown. Everybody goes silent except for Corey at the organ. And man, I tell you, it was if even the band didn't stop playing, there was so much funk generated just from that mm-hmm. one human being. I was looking around and making sure that the bass player wasn't still going, but he wasn't. I mean, it was all Corey, and the crowd just ate it up. But there's something, Nate, I'm glad you brought this clip to us. There's something about Corey mm-hmm. and drummer Tayron Lockett in the Revival that is so pure and piercing. I would have to say that that's my favorite context to hear him in, because there's nowhere to run. And with the spotlight only on these two cats, it's like the full meal. You don't need anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm trusting that they've done some live streams, the two of them, over this pandemic. I'm trusting that they can return to the road really soon in this format, because it's going to blow a lot of people's minds.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that, man.
Of course. And, you know, you just reminded me in recalling that gig, I almost forgot to ask you about the role of the bass in these organ mm-hmm. combos. You know, the fact that organists mm-hmm. are responsible with their foot pedals and sometimes with their left hand for creating mm-hmm. those bass lines. And as a bass player yourself, what thoughts do you have about mm-hmm. about that custom that feels so unique? Because it does, right? It's mm-hmm. so different. And I dare say it's its own special thing.
It is. So much so. Man, when I first started playing, I'm an electric bassist. But I really wanted to get that acoustic vibe and acoustic note choice together, but I couldn't really hear sometimes on the old 50s recordings or 40s recording what Curly Russell or Percy Heath were doing. But when I turned on a Jimmy Smith record or a Dr. Lonnie Smith record or a Larry Young record, I could hear the bass right away. So first of all, audibility is key in this setting. Secondly, I'm going to step out on a limb here and say that some of the most grooving bass players are Hammond organists. And I stand by that.
Yes.
Because there are fewer note choices, right? On this bottom deck of keys, the bottom manual, there are fewer note choices to make the thing sound authentically bass before it starts going into this, you know, mid-range or trebly category. So as the guys are hovering in these two octaves and with the foot pedals, fewer note choices deepen the groove. And I feel like a lot of times, man, the organ jazz takes off as well as it does off of what you just said, the Hammond organist's ability to really be the primary bass player in this band. And I wish more cats would pick up on that language, whether they play upright or electric guitar. These guys are masters of groove. The economy brings that out, and the note choice really helps to make that happen.
Yeah. And interacting with those bass lines is something that not every drummer can do effectively.
Truth. But
I love when you hear someone like Joe Dukes or Bill Stewart or, you know, back in the day in Philly, I used to hear Mickey Roker.
Oh, yeah.
At Ortlieb's.
Wow.
You know, sometimes he'd be playing with Trudy Pitts, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the few in-person shows that I saw last year, I've written about it, was with John Medeski, Mark Rebo, and Joe Dyson.
Ooh,
and Joe Dyson is another one, you know, he knows what to do.
Yeah.
And so, there's something really hip about it. And, you know, I'm not being as articulate as I'd like, but I think you really nailed it. Just that the economy of the range being sort of a spur to creativity. You know, you figure out a way to make it work. And sometimes that's the hippest thing.
Mm-hmm. As we continue to think about new players adopting this tradition, one thing that came across my desk from a guy who I respect a lot is the guitarist Charlie Hunter. He's a hybrid guitarist. He plays bass and lead out of the same instrument. He said, "Hey, man, I want you to take a listen to somebody that I'm working with here in North Carolina. He's a cat that you hadn't heard of, but I'm having a ball playing with him, and I'm just playing six-string guitar. But you know how much I love these organ trios. That's something that you and I have bonded over, Greg. I want you to hear this new cat named Sam Frybush. We got together in a trio setting with the drummer Jeff Clapp, and I think this is going to be right up your alley." And boy, it is, man. I tell you, like, the song selection, the vibe, the jam, it's just like organ 2021 with all the trimmings of the history and the vintage of the players that we know and love. And I had to share this with you, Nate. I hope you dug it too, because it knocked me out, man.
I'm so glad that you brought Sam Frybush to my attention, because he was entirely off my radar. You know, and once I spent time with this album, I was like, this is a best kept secret if ever I've heard one. You know,
that's cool.
There's so much groove on this album. You're right. It's very contemporary. It's very it's also very connected to this whole tradition. And yeah, he's somebody that I think a lot of people are going to dig. And I think let's talk about him some more. But I think we got to hear him first.
Yeah.
There's a couple of tunes on this album that are covers from D'Angelo's Voodoo, which Charlie Hunter appeared on. So Spanish Joint and The Root. Really cool to hear that in this organ trio context. But for our purposes here, I thought it would be cool to check out this trio when it's really sort of swinging. And so this is an original composition called Fly Fry. Thank you. That was Fly Fry by the Sam Frybush Organ Trio, featuring Charlie Hunter on six-string electric guitar and Jeff Clapp on drums. And man, what a great discovery. And it's funny, when you mentioned what Charlie said to you, it's a really good reminder that when I first heard Charlie Hunter in the 90s on those Blue Note albums, you know, because of his eight-string guitar mm-hmm. and the way that he processed his lower notes, I thought, oh, here's a guy who figured out how to be in an organ trio without an organ. You know, it was so clear that he loves yeah. that language, and the ingenuity that he has as a guitarist, you know, really was this interesting accommodation where, like, he was able to get that some of that vibe, you know, and be able to be a little more portable mm-hmm. than an actual organ trio at the time. And so one cool thing about this album to me, in addition to Frybush and his playing, is just hearing Charlie on a six string axe, you know, just kind of straight down the middle, you know, and he sounds so great. You know, everybody does on this album.
Yeah. It's a party, man. It's a party. You know, just a little bit more about Sam. You know, he went to the New England Conservatory and went back down to New Orleans, and he and his friends down there were doing okay on the local scene. And then this pandemic situation happens, the gigs dry up, and he moves back home to the Greensboro area in North Carolina, and runs into Charlie. So it's a bit of serendipity here. But again, these two could not have found better partners musically for each other, because there's all this grease, grit, groove, and intelligence too. Mm-hmm. And you put that all together and you get this modern take on this great organ tradition. Yeah, I'm glad we were able to play some of that for our folks out there.
It's very easy for me to imagine this band hitting the road and really bringing in audiences, you know, and audiences who love the, you know, this B3 tradition that we've been talking about, but also people from that jam mm-hmm. band community, you know, people who are just there for like mm-hmm. really heavy groove. I feel like this band can mm-hmm. span that, you know, those two different constituencies really easily. So in this conversation, Greg, we've resolved that we want to see the Sam Frybush Trio in person. I think you also floated the idea of a Corey Henry gig. We've got a lot of gigs lined sure. up on our wish list. So, you know, here's hoping it happens soon.
Man, you know what? All we have to do is go into our production studio at 54 Park Place,
yeah.
pull out our C3 and, see if we can get some good times and some good vibe, the Newark classic way with these new cats, man. That might be a solution if we can pull this off.
This is an instrument that has been played by New Jersey's own Matthew Whitaker. It's been played by Brian Charette. It's been played by Sullivan Fortner. And Joey mm-hmm. DeFrancesco has graced this instrument. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm leaving yep. out a bunch of folks. But yeah.
Dr. Lonnie Smith.
Dr. He's Lonnie also Smith. Played it. Dr. Mm-hmm. Lonnie Smith. Oh, well,
yeah.
Greg, you know how to bring us right back to the root chord. we want to wish the very best to all of these incredible musicians, especially Dr. Lonnie Smith, who has just shown us the way for so long. And you know,
yeah.
big congratulations yeah. to him and to Blue Note for this album, Breathe. It is really soul affirmative. You know, it's
man,
it's so reassuring and so positive.
That's the word, soul affirmative. The most cool I've ever felt in life, soul affirmed, was walking down Harlem, 125th Street, I believe it was, with Dr. Lonnie Smith, and we were headed up to an IHOP, which happened to be the former site of Small's Paradise. That was the hippest I think I've ever felt as a part of this music community.
Yeah.
And when you say that word soul affirmative, man, that's my identity with that. So thanks for putting that out, man. It triggered a good memory.
Yeah. Hang on to that.
Before we get out of here, we have this idea that we'd like to put forward, a new segment that we'd like to introduce on our show called This I Dig, of course, in the tradition of the great Hank Mobley tune on Soul Station. Just things that are dear to us that we may stumble on for the first time, or things that we've enjoyed that we'd just like to share. It could be musical, something in our community or outside of it. I guess I'll go first today. Many of you may know that I'm a serious vinyl collector. I have to pace myself and stop myself from buying records because I just dig records too much, probably. And the most recent acquisition that I have is this classic 1963 record with Elvin Jones and Jimmy Garrison as leaders. I first found this record in college, actually. It was first reissued on disc. And in my little community, we all went wild over it because I think, barring one other session, this was the only time that McCoy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, and Elvin Jones got together outside of the John Coltrane Quartet. The horn players on this record, Illumination, are Prince LaShaw, Charles Davis, and Sonny Simmons. And it's a good time all the way from the start to the finish. If you haven't heard it, Illumination, this copy definitely set me back a few bucks, but it's all worth it to get an original pressing from 1963 to see what the musicians intended, as well as the original pressing engineer, Rudy Van Gelder.
Wow. That would be very, very, very cool to hear on a good system. My endorsement this week, you know, this perhaps will be slightly redundant because I've already talked about this album a bit, but it really is the thing that has loomed largest for me. And this is the new album by Pharoah Sanders with Floating Points and the London Symphony Orchestra. This album is called Promises. Nice. I reviewed it for NPR Music, and we did an NPR Music listening party for this album. It's such an immersive album. It is incredibly deep, I think, and a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I have no doubt that it will be in the conversation when it comes time for the album of the year. You know, it's that special. And once again, you know, as with Dr. Lonnie Smith, Pharoah Sanders is in his, you know, I guess you'd say he's in his twilight, but he is still just doing incredibly beautiful things and really, you know, once again, showing us the way. We have had a wonderful time keeping this podcast going. We want to say that Jazz United is a production of WBGO. Our producer is the fearless Sarah Kirsten. Our senior producer is Simon Rentner. And Greg and I love doing this. We hope that you subscribe and please spread the word. Let people know about this show because we want to keep growing this platform.
We need your support to keep doing exactly what we do here at WBGO. You can do that with your financial support. Your tax-deductible secure contribution can go online, wbgo.org/support. That's where you can go to become a sustaining member of WBGO. We produce shows like this, like The Checkout, like Jazz Night in America, and 24 hours a day, 7 days a week programming that entertains, inspires, and educates. Again, support WBGO by going online, wbgo.org/support, and giving your financial contribution today. And we thank you.